Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from July 22, 2017. This Saturday's talk and Sangha discussion is the sixth of seven talks on the Satipatthana Sutta, the Sutta on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. Today's talk is the sixth in the series. We started with on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta. We started with the instructions the Buddha gave on applying the Four Foundations of Mindfulness during meditation, to be mindful of our breath and our bodies, our feelings, our thoughts, and how those three components contribute to the quality of our mind. And then we applied the Four Foundations of Mindfulness to the five clinging aggregates, the five hindrances. Last week we talked about the sixth sense base and to be mindful of contact through our senses, and to be mindful of the process that follows from that contact. And today we'll talk about the being mindful of the seven factors of awakening. And then we'll talk about mindfulness in relation to the Four Noble Truths. And then the Buddha concludes the sutta in a remarkable way. He provides some guarantees for what we can expect if we actually apply mindfulness in the way that he taught it. The Buddha continues in the sutta, "Furthermore, one remains mindful of the quality of mind in reference to these seven factors of awakening. Remain mindful that mindfulness is a factor of awakening within me." Meaning we need to be inwardly focused and mindful in the way that the Buddha's now outlined. "If mindfulness as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful that mindfulness as a factor of awakening is not present within me." Simply be mindful that you're not being mindful. But it's important. I mean, it does sound silly to say that, but again, the Buddha thought that it was so important to point that out in the beginning of this aspect of mindfulness. To be mindful that you've lost your mind in some way. You're distracted in some way. And remember the progression. You're distracted by probably sensory input, or the need for constant sensory input, which is the same as saying, "I need constant distraction." There's an intention behind being less than mindful. And the Buddha continues, "And be mindful of how mindfulness as a factor of awakening will arise." Simply be mindful that this is what we're developing. "Remain mindful of the culmination of the development of mindfulness as a factor of awakening." In other words, we're developing, constantly refining mindfulness as this ongoing process. "Remain mindful that investigation of the Dhamma is a factor of awakening. If investigation of the Dhamma as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful that investigation of the Dhamma is not present, and be mindful of how investigation of the Dhamma as a factor of awakening will arise," meaning through appropriate mindfulness, or that sixth factor of the Eightfold Path, right effort. Remember how the Buddha describes being mindful of that. Be mindful when engaged in wrong effort, and enter and remain in mind in right effort. That's exactly what the Buddha is talking about here. "Remain mindful that persistence is a factor of awakening. If persistence as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful that persistence is not present, and be mindful of how persistence as a factor of awakening will arise." Meaning we have to cultivate persistence. There's an intention behind that. It doesn't just arise. The Eightfold Path provides the guidance for that. "Remain mindful of the culmination of the development of persistence as a factor of awakening. Remain mindful that joyful engagement with the Dhamma is a factor of awakening. If joyful engagement with the Dhamma as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful that joyful engagement with the Dhamma is not present, and be mindful of how joyful engagement with the Dhamma as a factor of awakening will arise." We cultivate that. It's a remarkable thing to finally realize that here is a true path of developing lasting peace and contentment in the world. And as we develop that understanding, upekkha, joyful engagement, should naturally arise. This is I mean, when I think about how I finally came to the understanding of what the Buddha taught, the simple and direct application, and that it would likely lead to what I was seeking, which was, didn't really realize it until I came across it. I didn't know what I was looking for. But seeking lasting peace and contentment in this life, it really is remarkable. And I still remember having this thought, and it's not that I have some brilliant special mind, it's a common human mind. But because of that, I have a mind that can engage with the Dhamma and awaken, as the Buddha describes awakening. How fortunate is that? That's reason alone for joyful engagement with this. This is nothing supernatural or mystical. We don't need any special powers. All we need to do is to engage in mindful right effort and develop the Dhamma. That's what the Buddha's talking about here. And when these qualities aren't present, to cultivate them, to give birth to them within ourselves. Remain mindful of the culmination of the development of joyful engagement with the Dhamma as a factor of awakening. Remain mindful that serenity is a factor of awakening. If serenity as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful that serenity is not present, and be mindful of how serenity as a factor of awakening will arise. So how does serenity develop? Initially with a well-concentrated mind. That first factor of meditation, shamatha vipassana meditation, points to developing a tranquil mind through mindfulness of the breath, or serenity. And also that aspect of regular seclusion or disentanglement from the world, primarily in our meditation cushions, but hopefully off of those cushions. That's how we cultivate serenity. We stop being continually engaged or entangled with the outside world. And that's not only on our cushions. Off our cushions, we do not have to be engaged with the world otherwise, as best we can. And that's another aspect of mindfulness, isn't it? Remain mindful of the culmination of the development of serenity as a factor of awakening. It's something that we need to cultivate. Remain mindful that concentration is a factor of awakening. If concentration as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful that concentration is not present, and be mindful of how concentration as a factor of awakening will arise, specifically through meditation. If we find that we're not as well concentrated as we need to maintain mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, what do? Continue to meditate, continue to deepen our meditation practice. Remain mindful of the culmination of the development of concentration as a factor of awakening. These are such incredibly practical teachings. The Buddha is saying, if you find that you're not well concentrated now, continue to practice and you will. Remain mindful that equanimity is a factor of awakening. If equanimity as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful that equanimity is not present, and be mindful of how equanimity as a factor of awakening will arise through continued practice. Remain mindful of the culmination of the development of equanimity as a factor of awakening. In this way, one remains mindful of the seven factors of awakening and the arising and the passing away of the seven factors of awakening. Interesting line. None of this can we establish as permanent. And so if we find at any point that we are less than serene, or our minds are less than equanimous, or we're not well concentrated, remember that these factors will arise and they'll pass away. And be mindful of both sides of that same coin. It's important to be, Lorna brought this up a couple weeks ago, so important. And when you were talking about, you noticed the arising but not often the passing away, and now you're noticing it more because you recognize that. It's important that we recognize when we are outside of the parameters of mindfulness, meaning that our minds are less than serene or we're less than well concentrated. But it's as important to recognize when we are serene, when we are well concentrated, and to be mindful that the process is developing within us, the process of awakening. And not in a craving way or a clinging way, simply be mindful of that. And to be mindful that at any point, being well concentrated, having a peaceful, contented mind, may be impermanent, and that's okay. To be at peace with any quality of mind. And that avoids the need to start clinging to a pleasant quality of mind, to a skillful quality of mind. Oh, I've attained something. I got to hold on to it. Because what are we setting ourselves up for? Just disappointment. And that disappointment leads to further distraction. And it can lead to, remember when we talked about the hindrance, the one hindrance of doubt and skepticism. If we're placing too much importance on maintaining skillful qualities of mind, that can lead to doubt and skepticism, saying, oh, this doesn't work, or it doesn't work for me. I'm not capable of it. Simply recognize the arising and the passing away of skillful and unskillful qualities of mind. That's what the Buddha's pointing out here. It's interesting. He never teaches the Dhamma in the sense of a competitive goal to acquire. In other words, I'm fighting against myself to become awakened. He teaches awakening as an ongoing process of letting go of the need to be any different than you are in the moment. That is such a critical point of the Dhamma.
Can you say it again?
I hope I can. At any point in time, the Buddha is teaching that at any point in time, I can't say it again, I don't remember what I said. At any point in time, pardon me?
You said, like, resisting ourselves.
If we set awakening up as a competition within ourselves, we're setting ourselves up for failure. But if we learn to accept ourselves right as we are and recognize that we've found this incredible path to awakening, and all that we need to do is to continue to engage in the path, we'll let go of all of those self-referential views that we've been hurting ourselves with, attacking ourselves with. Remember the Salatha Sutta. At any point in time, if we're maintaining this refined mindfulness of the Dhamma, our minds will continue to incline towards awakening. But if at any point we start judging ourselves using the wrong aspects of the Eightfold Path, saying, I'm not well concentrated, what's the matter with me now? How did I lose my serenity? Yesterday I was so serene, today I'm not. The Buddha's pointing out, and I hope I am too, the arising and the passing away of all mind states, even those ones that define awakening, until we've reached the other shore, until we've awakened, they are going to be impermanent. It's the nature of the environment that we're in. But it's only because of a self-referential ego self that we judge those, the arising and the passing away. We want to hold on to one thing. We want to be awakened right now, and I don't want to go through the process. If we learn to accept ourselves as we are, right in this present moment, recognizing the arising and the passing away of dukkha, the arising and the passing away of the five clinging aggregates, remember, that was part of this talk on the Satipatthana Sutta, being mindful of the engagement or the clinging to the five clinging aggregates, and simply notice the unbinding of the attachment to form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness. They're just temporary states. Remain mindful of the culmination of the development. I went back one. Let me do that. Remain mindful of the culmination of development of equanimity as a factor of awakening. In this way, one remains mindful of the seven factors of awakening and the arising and passing away of the seven factors of awakening, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world, which also points to clinging to that I need to be any different than I am. And again, just to emphasize it, be mindful that you're engaged in this incredible process of awakening and that any human being can do this. Clinging to anything in the world. And that also refers to, and I hear this in, you know, in different ways, and we've talked about it here, that something occurs in the outer world, and it might be something that is just personal to us, or it might be a somewhat earth-shattering event. And we become distracted, and so distracted by that, that we feel like, how can I engage in Dhamma practice? How can I meditate when all this stuff is going on in my personal life or in the world at large? That's precisely the time when we should do it. No matter what's going on, whether it's personal or whether it's national or global, remember to meditate. Remember to be mindful of that factor of right effort. It's most important, especially when we think that now I can't do it because I'm so distracted. What you're realizing, if you're in a very subtle way, that you become so attached to something in the outer world, and you're using that attachment to say, I can't meditate. The Buddha recognized that 2,600 years ago. Things were just as occasionally immediately dire back then, and he noticed that distraction. It's the most important time to develop, to continue to develop awakening. This is how one remains mindful of the seven factors of awakening in and of themselves. These are my words here. Remaining mindful of the seven factors of awakening is mindful acknowledgement of developing the Eightfold Path correctly. Mindfulness of the seven factors of awakening may occur during meditation, but should not necessarily be cultivated just during meditation. The concentration developed during meditation will provide the spaciousness and focus to notice these seven factors and serve as continued direction. Is that last paragraph clear? You heard me say often, concentration in meditation is primarily so that we can hold in mind the refined mindfulness of the entire Eightfold Path, and that points directly to holding in mind these seven factors of awakening. To simply be mindful of when we're in these qualities of mind and be mindful when we're not. Before I go on to the next section on the mindfulness of the Four Noble Truths, any questions about this? Lorna?
You seem to be talking about yourself in a very positive way. I am mindful of this and I am mindful of that, or I am not mindful. And you're referring to I.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting very confused with anatta, that, you know, you're not yourself and blah, blah, blah. My head's beginning to spin with it. I don't know when to refer to myself as myself, as an I, or when not to think of myself as anatta, I.
Thank you. It really is a good question, because it can be very, very confusing that we're not supposed to have any self-referential views. When you're engaged in Dhamma practice in a dispassionate, impersonal way, and you can apply the mindfulness in that way, it simply helps you to keep focus. And the subtle thing in that, and what I just talked about, is to not become in competition with yourself, not judge yourself harshly. And that's how you avoid going from engaging in something, which is as incredibly personal as Dhamma practice is, but being able to do it in an impersonal way, to not judge yourself harshly. And that's how you avoid the I-making in it. It can be a confusing aspect, especially when you're losing the focus of the Eightfold Path, that there's no such thing as me. Now remember, the Buddha didn't say there's no such thing as a self. He simply said that the views that arise from ignorance do not constitute a self. Let go of those views. And this is a way of recognizing those views and letting them go and developing right view. So awakened right view is a quality of mind that is non-self-referential. In other words, that whatever is occurring, the mind is simply a reference point to what's occurring in the world. And there's no me in it. There's no need for me to judge it in any way. There's no need for me to think that things should be different. And specifically in Dhamma practice, as we're recognizing skillful and unskillful qualities, we do it in an impersonal way. There's no me here. I'm not judging myself harshly. Is that clear? Does that help that?
I'll listen to the tape again. It's a lot to take it.
Yeah, I hope so. Maybe a few times. I know it was something that I struggled with for a very long time until I understood. And this is where people that haven't had much of a engagement with modern Buddhism or Buddhism in general have an easier time, because it's often portrayed that there is no such thing as a self, and that the self is part of this grand emptiness scheme. And that's not what the Buddha taught. The Buddha is not teaching annihilation. He's simply teaching to let go of ignorant views. Remember, dependent origination says from ignorance through 12 observable causative links, suffering arises. So the Buddha is teaching to be empty of views rooted in ignorance, but he's not teaching annihilation of a self. Remember, the Buddha was a human being who awakened. and he spent 45 years of the most effective life any human being ever lived. He didn't vanish. There was still a human being engaged in this, in what he did for 45 years. He simply had disentangled himself from the world, meaning that the world didn't need to be any different than it was, and he could go on living in a peaceful, contented life. I don't need for anything to be different. That's what this is referring to. And that's the problem. It's when you get caught up in a self-referential ego self that difficulties arise. And the only reason that a self-referential ego self arises, the only reason that anatta arises, the only reason that five clinging aggregates arise, is from ignorance. Diane had a hand up.
Would help me with that not self kind of thing was, and I suppose everybody comes to it their own way, was real. I would be doing something or thinking something, and I would all of a sudden think, ah, that's ego. And when I recognized an ego thought that put me down, that made me better than somebody else, that thought I knew the solution to everything or, you know, something like that, I'd say, oh, okay, hello, ego. And it would just bring me back into... the words non-self and stuff like that are kind of... mysterious or, you know, yeah, undefinable kind of thing. It's like... you'll get it.
Thank you, Diane. The word, I think, and again, this is just what goes on in all of our heads. I think not self is a better word than non self, because to me, non self points to nothingness and emptiness. That there is no such thing as a self. The Buddha is just saying that the views you hold of yourself are not a self, and it's okay to be confused about some of these things. You know, that's part of the process. Again, it's a Buddha. Why the reason why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path is he recognized that going from views rooted in ignorance to views rooted in reality was going to be a challenge. We need this framework. We need a way to recognize when we're stuck in some confusing views. Another way of looking at it, and Diane really said it well, when your mind is disturbed in some way, it's because you're looking at something from the point of view of an ego self. You know, and there's a little bit of maintenance. I don't know who was first, but I'm going to go with Jen.
So
no offense, Liz.
What I was hearing Lorna say was sort of the reference to I in my own head. If I say, you know, I'm frustrated, I'm angry, or I'm sad, I'm whatever, that, like, at first glance, I could call that wrong speech because I'm feeding an ego self by speaking to the ego self. And it, you know, I guess you could argue that it is. But the middle way is helpful there.
Yeah.
Where you say, okay, well, I'm still on a weekend. So I have to at least allow these thoughts and feelings to arise.
Yes.
In order to mindfully observe them. And if I'm struggling to, like, not let them arise because I don't like the phrase I am or I feel or whatever, then I'm engaged in that fight and I'm resisting ego and feelings and thoughts and ego's in charge.
Yeah, that's exactly it. We can get caught up in just using the self-referential I.
Right.
But of course we have to. Even the Buddha would often refer to himself when I was an unawakened bodhisattva. In other ways, he would refer to himself. He's simply describing a point of view of when he was stuck in something, but he also referred to himself as the Tathagata, the one who awakened. And he would describe that. He would describe awakening for all of us as being rightly self-awakened. Rightly self-awakened. We do it ourselves. And what do we do? What happens when I am awakened? then I am no longer stuck in wrong views. Including the need to establish myself as the great awakened one. Simply awakened, simply living my life in the most meaningful way possible. I've let go of the need for anything to be any different. And that's a self-referential view, that life should be different or I should be different.
So there's like a self-referential I and then not
yes.
self.
Yeah, that's it. That's thank you.
The difference is the view.
The difference is the view, from right view to wrong view. That's it. That's the. In fact, that's the description of awakened right view. Awakened right view, the way the Buddha describes it, I think it's up on the wall, is awakened right view, fully developed right view, profoundly understands dukkha. How does the Buddha describe dukkha? He culminates with saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha, are suffering, confusion, delusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. We understand it.
Can I
just
say that again?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you'll
have to listen to it.
Let's go to the videotape.
I said there's a self-referential I and a non-self-referential I.
Yeah.
And the difference is right view and non-ignorance. One doesn't have ignorance.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Wait, Liz has been. Okay. Liz, please.
That's what I was going to say. So if you listen back, if you listen back to the tape, what you'll hear is John talking about I as a point in the phenomenal world, that it distinguishes you from you from you from you, and that's
yeah.
one way of, through the skillful use of the Dhamma, having I be a self-referential point in the phenomenal world. It's when the I arises and causes that unsatisfactory level in life through anatta, anicca, and dukkha, that it's the unskillful use of the Dhamma. So there's a difference between the I as a reference, you know, as a point in time, and then the I, and what Lorna said on Tuesday night when she was playing the game of mindfulness and had a timer on her phone, and every 5 minutes she would check in with herself to see where she was. I was thinking earlier when you were talking about the direct words of the Buddha and you were saying, okay, I'm not in the right mindfulness. And I could just see Lorna going through her house saying, I'm dusting the table. And then the timer goes off and goes, I am not in a skillful mindless position. I am dusting, then go back, I am dusting the table. Ding, I am not in a skillful mindless position. I just see her repeating herself over and over again, I'm not in the right mindless
position. Caught in a loop.
Yeah.
That's the feedback.
Lessons from Lorna.
Thank you. Diane, you
think the hard part of all of this is feeling from point A to point B. I mean, I just can't intellectually turn off something because my body, and I mean, my whole being is in it. And as I feel my way through it, you know, almost as though there's a guiding force or something like that. That's the hard part. It's like if I can see something intellectually, okay, that's one thing. But then when I have all of these feelings that I'm dealing with, I think ego I thinks that shouldn't be, and I want to feel good right now. But the only way I get to peace and acceptance is to go through the feeling. And that's the yucky part of it. That's the dukkha of the dukkha.
And that's being at peace with less than peaceful mind state. Another way of looking at this and mindfulness is what I'm feeling and what I'm thinking in this moment appropriate to what's occurring? Meaning, another word for appropriate would be accepting, because it is. Or am I? And when we're struggling with ourselves in relation to the Dhamma and all these confusing questions that can arise, Is it appropriate for me to be confused in this moment? Of course it is. It's what's occurring.
That's
be at peace with that and come back. That awakening is full human maturity. So the questions that we develop are skillful questions if we don't insist on an answer that feeds a self-referential ego self and just allow the question to be there and continue with Dhamma practice, because eventually the Buddha guarantees, we'll get to it today, the Buddha guarantees we'll develop understanding of even these confusing aspects of it. It speaks to the Salatha Sutta too, that the sticking the second arrow in, you know, and getting caught in that feedback loop that the Buddha described in his in the Nagara Sutta. It's all part of it. It's all part of developing Dhamma, to recognize that. And to recognize that all feelings and all thoughts are appropriate if they have no self-reference in them. And I think I left you all.
No.
At any point, we can... Not everyone.
You can have a feeling without a self-referential point. I guess that's the whole key to the capsule.
It is, because if I recognize that in this moment I'm reacting from a wrong view, that is a key to developing understanding. How else could we do it? But I have to be at peace with being temporarily seeing the world from wrong view. I have to accept it. Mm-hmm. If I want to get from point A, the metaphor that I often use is, if I'm in New York and I want to go to California, but I believe I'm in Chicago, I can't get there. We have to know where we are. We have to accept where we are. In this moment, I'm in wrong view. I'm reacting to what's occurring, whether it's my own view of myself or the world around me. And in that moment, if I can recognize and accept what's occurring, then I can move towards awakening in the next moment. If I judge myself harshly or what's occurring in the world harshly, I'm now simply creating more views rooted in that same ignorance.
That's where the change of behavior happens. Mm-hmm. When I'm experiencing the feelings of something, the extreme regret and pain of something that I did that came up in meditation years ago, or a relationship with my parents or something like that, and I see my part in it, what I did, the choices I made, and the abandonment of self, or, you know, the abandonment of, you know, anything, and feeling through that, I see the whole thing differently, and I can make different choices. But unless I feel that agony of what I did, sometimes I'll walk around the house thinking, that was so stupid. How could you have been so, you know, and I'm beating myself up. But then when I stay with it, and that's what I've learned to do, is stay with where I am, what's going on right now with me. And that's the hard part. That's what I'm saying. Because, and I know now, when I stay with the feelings, what is it? The narrative remains, but the emotional attachment is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it's like I can see with equanimity myself. Then I didn't know any better. And the we don't use the word forgiveness, but the
acceptance.
What? Kindness. Toward myself is so freeing and relieving of so much baggage that I can let it. But that's the hard part again, is staying with myself and feeling those feelings, and not, you know, I mean, the condemnation may even come, but that's where the whole thing to me starts to come together, the impermanence. I feel these things, I allow them to be what they were, and then they're gone. The story, you know, the narrative may be there, but the feelings that I have harbored in my body in various ways and in my mind
that have kept me doing the same thing over and over and over again because of those, mistakes or the error thinking that I did in the past. Once I experience them for what they are, so many times I have done something. I can even see myself sometimes doing it now. I'll do something and I'll think, oh my gosh. And then life is happening around me and I don't get a chance to feel it at all. And I just am rushing through. I mean, there's not a time, there is not the time to just circumstantially. And then because I continue to meditate and have the Eightfold Path in my mind, I revisit. I go back and I take the time to go through the situation and then feel what I didn't feel. Because it's, I think, ego's number one trick is to get me sidetracked.
That's another way of saying that you recognize the passing away too. What you're first describing, getting stuck in the world, is you're only stuck in the arising and you don't see the passing away, so you never understand impermanent.
And that distraction of ego.
Yeah.
To distract you. Oh, you don't need to do that. You don't need to. That's okay. That's, for me, the importance of recognition.
Yeah, and that's the constant distraction of the ego too, the need to do that. It's a very subtle strategy of maintaining ignorance, isn't it? You know, that which is the sole purpose of an ego personality. Diane mentioned the word emotion. An emotion, a good description of an emotion, is a thought attached to a feeling, or a thought clinging to a feeling, meaning something has arisen, and I decide that it must be different in some way, more or less. I don't like it, I like it, whatever it is. And remember, we talked about how that sets in a subtle obsession around whatever that object is. And we keep creating. We get into this feedback loop. Conditioned mind keeps creating the same situation over and over again. Liz.
So this is the point that you've made in terms of the awakening, is that if you, through the skillful use of the Dhamma, transfer those kinds of thoughts that are trying to distract you into those meditations of what you were saying. I am what the Buddha was saying about, I recognize that I'm not in a mindful state, or I recognize that I'm not. So that's all part of the concept of being able to choose your thoughts.
Yes. Learning to think what you want to think when you want to think it. It's another way of describing a fully awakened, fully mature human being. You're in complete control of your thoughts.
Mm.
And wouldn't that make sense?
Mm.
That as a fully mature human being, I am in control of. Even when the Buddha describes why not self is not a self, he says it because you're not in control of it. How could it be a self if you're not in control of it? It can't be. Why would you even describe something as a self that you're not in control of? Doesn't make sense. Even that idea is rooted in ignorance. This is me, but I can't control it? Who would want a me like that? But I know that for a great portion of my life, I was in absolutely no control of what I was doing. I was driven by obsessions and compulsions and wrong thinking. I did a lot of things. It doesn't mean that I never did a right, a thing rooted in reasonableness, but a lot of the choices I made were rooted in wrong view, and they led to suffering. It's just an example of five clinging aggregates. It's 9:45. I think we've really covered a lot today. So I think we'll conclude this maybe next week. Is that agreeable? I mean, I think we've covered enough. I'd like to have just go around the room. There really is a lot in this Four Foundations of Mindfulness. The sutta, the Satipatthana Sutta, is unfortunately another one of those suttas that have been adapted and accommodated to fit other views. But the entire instruction for developing the Dhamma is included in the sutta, and I guess that's why it's taking us nearly 2 months to get through it in a reasonable way. But this is the right application of mindfulness. This is how we should be viewing the world if we're inclined towards awakening, towards developing full human maturity in this reasonable way. And if you look at every one of these things that the Buddha is teaching and pointing to, they're all reasonable. They're all logical. It's what a person who's thinking is resting in reasonableness would want to think, like Liz pointed out. We learn to think what we want to think when we want to think it. We gain control of our thinking. And if we gain control of our thinking, we've now gained control of our entire experience of our life. It doesn't mean that we now can manipulate things around us. Earthquakes are still going to happen. Elections are still going to go on. People are going to be born and die. You know, people are going to come in and out of our lives on a personal level. But we will stop reacting to it because we have developed the ability to control our thoughts. And even that word control sometimes has a connotation people don't want. I don't want to be in control. It sounds too rigid, but it's a very gentle control. Remember, it's a control that's not referencing a self anymore.
Monitor.
Pardon me?
Monitor
a self, yeah. Constant vigilance, you know. And this can even happen in Dhamma practice. Am I thinking, is my thinking right? Instead of whatever's occurring, accept it. Because it's what's occurring. So.
It's Lorna's idea of the point of the arrow. When she talks about in this moment. Right there.
Just that
right
sharp.
There,
yep.
And then it's right there.
And just that pointed. The Buddha says the wise understand the danger and even the slightest deviation from the path. And again, it doesn't mean that we should be hyper-focused now on the Eightfold Path. It simply means we should recognize at that moment when we should practice restraint, when we're being mindful or mindless. Another way of saying mindless is to be holding in mind things that are arising from wrong view. It's an aspect of mindfulness, but it still leads to mindlessness. It's a lack of concentration. There's a lot here. So before we go around the room, are there any questions related to today's talk? And what to look forward to. I gave a talk Thursday on the mindfulness of Bahia, which is a very succinct teaching.
Mindfulness of
Bahia, the Bahia Sutta. Where Bahia was a monk who had maybe a too profound understanding of impermanence and thought that any moment he could die. And he wasn't sure if he had everything he needed, and he ran across the Buddha and he says, "You got to give me everything right now because you might die or I might die." I'm not going to give the whole teaching. And I was going to give this next week, but I'll conclude this series on mindfulness with the Bahia Sutta here 1 week after, whenever we finish this. So hopefully next week we'll conclude the Satipatthana. But the discussions have been so, you know, really well focused. It's really remarkable what we've all developed here as far as mindfulness of the Dhamma. So that's what's coming up. Anthony, good to see you this morning.
I don't know if I've never noticed it before, but that table looks so beautiful.
Yeah,
the flowers and the light and the ground's ball. I just wanted to point that out.
It is. It's
good
a
job.
Well, Matt got the table. I think from the guy right on the corner of Bridge Street up here.
Brett.
The modern, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he really has some beautiful stuff.
That's Brett's?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought.
No, no, actually, it's the guy on the corner.
The guy at the barbershop?
No.
The gas station thing.
Across the street from the gas station.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Brett does have beautiful stuff, too.
Yeah.
So to Diane's point, I thought of a great analogy. If a room is in the dark for 50 years and you turn the light on, it's going to look the same the first time as it did if you turned it on 50 years ago.
Wow, yeah, that's right.
So sometimes when I meditate, in the beginning, I was kind of hard on myself because every once in a while, I'll be thinking through the entire 20 minutes, but it's not really thinking, it's more like dreaming. Because one thought goes into a next, and the next thing I know, I wake up 20 minutes later. And I could be hard on myself for like, well, that was a good sleep that you had for 20 minutes. But what helps is to think, and it's almost like rebirth, that every day I get a chance to do this over again.
Yeah.
So I don't, I'm not so hard on myself if that happens.
Yeah, and it's so important to just to say that you got to start where you are. And in the beginning, it seemed like you weren't concentrating at all, even though you were training yourself to concentrate.
Yeah.
And it's so important. You got to be at peace at as best as you can with that.
It's a tough balance because we all know that there are benefits to doing this right.
Yeah.
And we want to do it right. And then sometimes it doesn't happen that way. So it's easy to be hard on yourself over that. But
it is. That's part of mindlessness or looking at yourself from a mindless point of view. The general teaching on mindfulness is to be gentle with yourself and be gentle with what's going on. Don't judge anything harshly.
Yeah.
And see things clearly.
To your other point, when you talked about how people use distraction as an excuse, I was thinking about that. If you talk to people about why they don't meditate, most of the time the reason it leads to some level of distraction.
Yeah.
I'm too busy.
Yep.
I don't have time in my life. I just think too much. I can't do it. Those are all excuses of I'm too distracted.
Yeah,
really.
Nearly everyone that I've ever taught told me the reason why I want to meditate is because I got this monkey mind. I can never stop it. And the reason why people stop is because they say I can't stop this monkey mind, which is precisely why you need. But it is a difficult, almost painful quality of mind to have. You know, when we've all, I think every one of us has been through it at some point, most of us. And you continue. You be at peace with less than peaceful mindset.
Yeah.
You be gentle with yourself.
Eventually, maybe you get to the point that Diane mentioned where you recognize you have this thought, but you don't have to bite down on it, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to believe it. It's sort of like, I think that we have these embedded repetitive patterns, and maybe through not biting down on it, it'll eventually go away, but it takes time because it's ingrained in you for so many years.
Are you going, Diane?
No, we're going.
Oh, good. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Good.
It's just become so ingrained with so many years of conditioned thinking.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a while to get rid of that pattern.
Take care of it. It does.
I'm clearing the room.
Yes, see,
I'll stop talking now.
That's all part of conditioned thinking. Yeah, pretty soon. All right, yeah, you got to stop.
All right, I'm done.
Thank you, Anthony. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning. It's good to be here. My practice is going well. Thursday night's class, where we talked a little bit more about what Laura said about watching things arise and pass away, and you said at one point, was that Tuesday? Sorry, yes, Tuesday's class. You said you can practice watching things arise and pass away with anything you're doing in your day. So being the overly disciplined person I can be, sometimes I got in my car and drove home and tried to stay with the drive home for the entire time. And I did not succeed. I've done that a couple times, and I don't think I've successfully made it to the end of any thing without. And what I noticed was towards the end, towards the passing away part, I am on to the next thing because I'm looking for that the next thing, and so that was very helpful. To see.
Yeah, what a great understanding of impermanence.
Yeah.
All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation.
I don't want to see the cessation.
Yeah. And we have to. look how that relates directly to the Buddha's teachings on suffering. Birth, sickness, aging, and death.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about things arising and ending. All of it. Not getting what you want, getting what you don't want. The five clinging aggregates. You look at each individual aggregate. Every one of them is impermanent. They arise and they pass away. All of them. So why take anything personal?
So the other thing, on to the next thing, is, and this happened at the same time. I don't know if there's a connection. It doesn't matter. I've noticed that the first step for me, it's very personal, but the first step for me for letting go of thoughts and feelings is to allow them to arise in the first place. And that has been interesting because I've recognized that I resist allowing things to arise. Mm-hmm. And that creates a lot of suffering.
A lot of stress. So what you resist persists. You can't.
Right. Yeah. And that's been very, really nice. Really, really nice. Because I feel like I've been sticking, uncomfortable. And I'm seeing my resistance to little tiny things, just subtle. I don't like, I'm having some sensation that I don't like, and I'm immediately like, it's very nice to allow those things to arise and kind of watch them pass away. And so
thank you. You're describing developing a great level of not self acceptance. When not self is arising and it's obvious, you just accept it because it's what's occurring.
Right.
And it's and that leads to impermanence too. When we recognize that views rooted in ignorance are manifesting in our lives in a personal way, we also recognize the impermanence of it. This is not me. It's just, remember, the Buddha teaches, this is not me. This is not myself. This is not who I am. Take a breath. Move into the next moment. It just diminishes. Thank you. Good morning, Becky.
Good morning, John. So nice to be here. Every time I come, I'm just so thankful to be here.
Me too.
My practice is getting a little more disciplined each week. However, my actual meditation sessions are still very monkey-minded. And when I'm here, they're less so. And I just have to keep working at it because when I'm not here, I'm in my world, and I tend to start to bring up the reasons that I don't have time, I'm distracted. But I have been saying, okay, distraction or not, go to your meditation place. It's time, and I've been very successful at doing that. At actually sitting down. But like I said, what I'm not successful at is really calming my mind as much as I would like to each time.
Yeah.
My mind, but I keep working at it, and I always feel good that I did it. I feel happy that I had the discipline to do it.
Yeah.
And calmer. Always calmer, a little bit. So, but coming here and talking, and one other thing I wanted to say is that I feel like I'm still very, very new to this. I don't know how long, January. But I still feel that reading the Dhamma makes me feel good.
Yeah.
I love to read it. And I'm just reading the first book over again. I just bought the Kindle edition. I just have it on my phone so I can just read it whenever I want. And when you said that earlier today, and you said taking to the Dhamma should be joyful. And I find that when I'm reading it, I just feel good reading it. So, thank you.
thank you for all that. I did too. I remember when I first came across the Buddha's words as preserved in the Sutta Pitaka. That's how I felt. wow, I got a library of Buddhist books, probably 300 of them. I don't want to get into how they always left me a little confusing. What's going on here? But when I read these words, even though they're presented in a way that's difficult to read, it was like, wow.
Well, I think reading your book over again, the first one, the first time I read it, I was like reading words.
Yeah, a lot of people
say
that.
But now that I've had your instruction and this Dhamma, or the Sangha, I can read it now, and it really feels good.
Yeah. Yeah. It takes...
comes in.
It takes repetitiveness, and it really does take a sangha. It takes the support,
right?
You know, weekly support, I guess. The new book is out on Kindle, and the printed version will be available for shipping on Monday, I hope. And I'll have some copies here, I think, by the end of next week.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, thank you. Glad you're here. Mary, good to see you.
Great to be here. It's always good to meet all the Saturday people. I hear from the Saturday people every week when I listen. Really good stuff. You said something in one of the talks this week, or it could have been last Saturday's talk, about how the mind... I'm not saying exactly how you said it, but how the mind and the body wants to be in balance. I mean, it wants to be at peace. And I think that's relevant to what we just talked about this morning, too, in that, you know, you can look for a million examples in nature, too, of how everything kind of tries to right-size itself. And so it's a human condition that we upend that. And now we're all trying to get back to the natural state that the mind and body wants, the equanimity of it all. I mean, that's really, you know, it's you know, not to be silly, but it is a lot like, oh, it was always inside of you all along.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is.
And to know that is that it's already there, so it's obtainable. Yeah. You know, we can do this.
Yeah, anybody can do it.
Yeah. It's really great. The other thing I wanted to share is my husband is reading your book.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look forward to the grand book signing, and I'll introduce him to you.
Wow, great. Yeah. we're gonna talk to, I don't know her name yet even, I guess it's a woman, I don't know why I'm assuming that, that owns the art yard, and see if we can put that together for early fall. But that's a great idea. Like a book signing, community day kind of thing. I'll give a little talk, and we'll see what happens. But Mary came up with that great idea last week, so we'll see. Yeah, we'll do. I mean, I guess if we don't do it there, that was the first place. That's a good suggestion, but we'll figure something out.
Here, actually.
Yeah, we could.
You know.
Yeah. Diane, good to see you this morning.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Good
Sorry.
To see you. No, it's okay. Say, tell Deborah I said hello.
I will. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for continuing steadfastly to have this and do this. I am happy. I think... this is not, and I think early on, when I started coming, you were saying, this is not for the faint of heart. And I think...
well, wait a minute, I got to cut you off. I said it's a practice of ease and joy, but it's not for the faint of heart.
Well, say it again.
I used to say that it's a practice of ease and joy, but not for the faint of heart. It's important to have both of those in there.
I'll have to. I don't remember the first part of that. That's funny. Okay, but anyway, it's what it teaches me most of all. I think is to stay with my non-self, stay with myself. You know, I think I too often would abandon myself through distractions, through thinking I was wrong, I'm not doing it the way my mother wanted me to do it, or my father wanted me, or my brother.
brother wanted me to do it, or I'm not doing it the way, yada, 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 yada. I'm doing it wrong, wrong, wrong. And going through those feelings is, and so I would abandon myself, like, and which definitely leads to low self-esteem, and thinking that I wasn't, you know, worth anything or valuable. But the more I practice this, the more this is, don't take this wrong. The more in love with who I am, I become, and that's probably the best thing that's ever happened to me. And I read a lot, and one of the things that I am thankful for is the metta, mm-hmm. and the placing of loving who I am, you know, may I be filled with loving kindness. First, if I don't, so often throughout the day, throughout the week, if I'm not loving me, loving who I am before everybody else, and it's so, I mean, I was raised to be out there doing for other people, do for them, put yourself last, and this taking care of me is first is I can't put enough, I don't know, it teaches me to respect who I am, teaches me to listen to I am, who I am, and none of this is the anyway. It enables me to validate, to be validated, and then once I kind of experience that, and it's not just intellectually or emotionally or anything like that, it's about my whole body. Mary was saying that, I mean, the other day I looked at my hands and I thought, you know, when my kids were born, I counted their fingers and toes a million times, just so tickled that they were all there. And I looked at my hands and I thought, how I treasured the hands of my children and the feet of my children, and I would, you know, feel them and touch them. And I thought, gee, I don't know that I've ever done that with my own. And I look at my toes differently and touch them. And it's like, and I feed, I continually search and find new ways to feed my body the fuel that it needs, and not the fuel that my ego thing or something advertisement tells me I want. And, I mean, this is a whole WHOLE path and journey that continues to, maybe it started out as a desert, but little cactus flowers and vines and stuff and waterfalls are beginning to decorate the landscape.
Thank you, Diane. Glad you're here this morning. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you. It's good to be here. It's nice to see everyone. I have nothing to say that I haven't already said, so thank you.
Thank you, Liz. I'm glad you're here. Lorna, good to see you. Good morning.
Good to be here. I think what prompted my question about Tamatara and how you refer to yourself, when you refer to yourself, I think I asked that question because that's what I'm thinking about. And I I making, and when it's correct to refer to your I, just yourself as just a point, you know, just as a name, just to refer to yourself as. So I think that's what I've sort of been thinking about, and that's why I really asked that question. So that's where I'm at. And just as I point out, there's a lot of the discussion, a lot of people said that there's been a lot of, when you are sort of kind of stuck in these questions, you know, just be such gentle with yourself, be kind with yourself, and this is a process, and don't get disheartened. And there's been a lot of sort of like nurturing talk of your own Dharma practice has been said this morning. And thank you for that. We could all do with hearing that sometimes.
Yeah. We can, and thank you for the question, because it inspired a great discussion this morning. The Sangha at work. Good morning, Debbie.
I just want to say that's exactly what the name of the woman just said, patience nurturing. I constantly still struggle with the concentration, less than the routine, the ritual. I've been doing this over a year now, but I remembered something helpful when I was in a postgraduate course at Johns Hopkins. It's about all about Asian meditations, and I remember the woman who gave it said, "I've been doing this for years, and I'm still, you know, it's taking me years to start to be able to concentrate." That was so affirming for me to be able to remember that. Mm-hmm. Hear this woman as she taught it, she was doing it for years, and she was, it's more than a daily practice. It's more than a year practice. You know, it's so that journey is remembering those has been helpful for me. And the other thing that's been helpful for me is just normal silence. Lately, I've just been trying to tap into that more and more. Just sit.
Thank you. Isn't it wonderful to be able to just sit quietly with nothing going on? I mean, it really is a true joyful aspect of life, is to be able to do that. And engaging in right effort and continued meditation practice to deepen concentration is just it. You know, it takes some time. Next week, I hope, we'll get to where the Buddha gives some guarantors about, you know, what you can expect by developing this type of mindfulness. And he goes from, if you do this the way it's taught, in 7 years, you're going to gain awakening. But if you really apply yourself, maybe 6 years, maybe even 5 years, and he takes it all the way down to just a few moments. It's up to us. Thank you, Debbie. Good morning, Mary. It's good to see you.
I have to say the thing that rings the most true with me is being at peace with less than peaceful mindsets.
Yeah.
It's so funny, because when you're in a, you know, you're okay sailing along, you know, nothing bothers you to sail along, but I always, when I get into a pit, it's hard for me to realize that I am going to see the other side of it. You always do.
Yeah.
And in reality, the best thing I can do would be to sit down and meditate, even if it's just for 5 minutes, because that settles things down. It settles things down immediately, but it's just hard to break out of the shell sometimes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I go through periods where it's harder, right now it's harder, and for now, you know, I'm glad I had this to go to.
Yeah, and to know the difference, and know that there's a way out.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, prior to this, you fall into a mind state, and you think that this, I'm going to feel this way forever.
Yeah.
It's like when you get a cold. When you get a cold, you think, forget that it's a temporary situation. I'm going to feel like this forever. Mind states are the same thing. And when we can be at peace with less than peaceful mind states, we can move through them much more gracefully, much easier. A great class. It's a little bit, it's quarter after 10, but I want to ask a quick question just because I'm changing the way that I present the podcast, and I'm going to be going to either an app that's just either through iTunes and through the website. In other words, it won't be the Podbean app. Does anybody have a feeling about that? Would it be a difficulty to you, if you're listening to my talks, would it be a difficulty to just go directly to the website on your smartphone and listen to the talks as opposed to an app? Okay.
That's what I do. Anyway. I go through the
Okay.
Website.
Yeah. Then you have to remember a password.
Yeah. No, you don't. Not on the website anymore.
Password, but, I use Podbean all the time, but that's just because that's the rhythm I got into. I guess I thought that was the way we're supposed to go. But I've also gone into the website.
Okay, so if there was a dedicated link that you could always maintain, you just hit the link and go to the website and you'd hear the podcast if you listen to it.
Yeah.
Because that's what there's some back-end reasons why I'm doing that.
And the link would be in your newsletter.
Yeah, I'll put that in the newsletter. And I guess you could just set it as a bookmark, too.
Right.
You know, but also, it'll still be available through iTunes if you use that. And I'll probably set it up that you can get the talks on Google Play, too.
What is nice is that they're in reverse order, you know, on Podbean. You know, I don't have to look for what happened this week.
The newest talk is it comes up on top.
Exactly.
This will be the same way.
Okay.
It'll just be directly on the website.
Great.
Good. Thank you for the feedback. Thank you for a great class. We'll finish with Metta as we always do. And I think we'll conclude this series next week, but you never know. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. Please visit becomingbuddha.com for guided meditations, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becomingbuddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through becomingbuddha.com. Peace.